Right, now, first question is, you are aware that you are being recorded for the use of my thesis on the logistics of the 101st Airborne Division for my master's degree at Austin Peay.
Correct.
Okay. Now, please, state your name and former rank.
Jack Hardwick, former rank is Command Sergeant Major.
Infantry, U.S. Army?
Infantry, U.S. Army.
Okay, and today's date is...
is the 30th of April, 2009.
Thank you. Now, the first question that I have for you is, when you were assigned to the 101st Airborne Division, when were you assigned, first of all?
In April of 1990.
Okay. And what unit were you assigned to?
I was assigned to 2nd Battalion, 187 Battalion, which is part of the 3rd Brigade, 101st.
Okay. Now, what were your duties in peacetime and in wartime when you were in your position?
Initially, peacetime, I was the 2nd Battalion, 187 Command Sergeant Major, which is responsible for the unit along with the commander on the things that they do and fail to do. And wartime, I was the 3rd Brigade, Command Sergeant Major. Same thing of duties and responsibilities, same pretty much as what the commander has.
Okay. Now, I have to ask, you know, how did that bump happen? You went from being a, you know, from being battalion to the brigade CSM. I mean, what happened?
The brigade Command Sergeant Major retired prior to the war actually kicking off.
Do you remember how soon that happened?
We got there in Saudi Arabia in September, and he retired in November.
Hmm. Do you remember if he was sad to go?
If he was sad to go?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Actually, and what was your very first impression of Saudi Arabia when you stepped off the plane?
Hot. It was 120 degrees.
I would melt into a puddle, man.
Yep.
Good lord. And that's a recurring motif that I have read, is that it was brutally hot.
Yep.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get acclimated to that?
Probably took us about 2 or 3 weeks to really get, I'd say, comfortable with activities and everything going.
Do you remember what sort of things you had to do in order to get acclimated?
We just did the normal PT training, army things.
And wait, did you do PT in the morning or in the middle of the day?
PT in the morning.
That's what I thought. So it was like a comfortable, what, like 70-ish then or something? Or
probably about 80 or 90.
Okay. So...
but it was comfortable. It was, yeah. Compared to USA, like they say, Arizona has a dry heat.
Yeah.
That was pretty much, Saudi was kind of dry, very low humidity, but hot is hot.
Did you ever get the impression that while some places would have an oven to bake things, Saudi Arabia had an entire country to do so?
All I know is just the place where we were at was that way. Then as we went, of course, as the months went along and the temperature changed, and then we went to different to location.
Mm.
It was cooler, but of course the seasons were changing. So
right, okay, and well, speaking of, when did you arrive in theater?
In Saudi Arabia.
Yes, in Saudi Arabia.
Alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we arrived there in September.
Okay. And how long after you received notification did you get sent out?
Well, I guess it was about a month.
Okay. So you had the usual cycle.
Well, actually, my battalion was in Panama going through jungle school when we got notified that we were supposed to be on a plane coming back to Fort Campbell because of the things that were happening. So we had about a week over in Panama, or 2 weeks in Panama, before we actually came back to Fort Campbell and began the pre-deployment training and everything.
Actually, how did the pre-deployment training correspond to the actuality of, you know, arriving in the desert? And, yeah, and that whole jazz.
Basically, just going off what information we had, the intel information, and what Iraq had, and what Saddam had done to his own people. Biggest training was to ensure that we had everyone up to date on their chemical knowledge and how to combat it, how to wear their chemical gear and train for it, doing road marches, those kind of things, in the chemical gear. And that, at Fort Campbell, even in the end of August, early September, it's pretty humid and pretty hot, so that was quite difficult at times for soldiers.
Yeah. Yeah, and, oh man, well, all right, my home state is Connecticut, so when I moved down here to go to Austin Peay, and good Lord, I couldn't believe how people live here. And, I mean, and it must be worse down there, too, yeah?
Yep.
Oh, man. Okay. Now the three places that you were at, FOB Bastogne, Camp Eagle 2, TAA Campbell, you know, first, how did the supply situations differ between them?
Well, at Camp Eagle 2, it was not bad because the whole division was right there, so the supply wasn't that far to go requisition, get to make sure it got to the units where it needed to go. As we went to different locations, of course, supply was further distance away. So it took a while. It took convoy movements to go to the distribution points and come back. And the requisition is same throughout the Army, though. Yeah. So that wasn't too bad.
Okay. Now concerning the movement of supplies, do you remember how often ground vehicles were used to transport men and supplies, and how often helicopters were used to do the same?
Most of the time, supplies were done by ground. Once we went up into Iraq, then it was done by air.
Okay. All right. Pardon me. Mm-hmm. All right. Before the ground war, and during the ground war, was there ever an over or an underabundance of any type of supplies? And you can feel free to, you know, take your time and divvy it up however you wish.
Undersupply on the first, I don't want to say the first day, but probably about the third day that we were in Iraq, because the weather had gone real bad with
the shmall from hell?
With the different sandstorms and all. So we had no air at all for about 3-4 days. So supplies were kind of limited then. But once the air, sandstorms subsided, we were able to get air and get resupplies, and then everything was good.
Okay. Actually, I'll definitely want to get more on when you guys were in Iraq on Highway 8. Now, what was your unit's assignment during the ground offensive? And what was your role within that?
We were to block Highway 8 from the enemy coming back to get back to Baghdad.
Right. And your role within that?
Basically, my role as the commanders was just to ensure that we had the blocking position set, each battalion had their engagement areas, and we were able to get around and ensure that those things were accomplished.
Okay. Now, pertaining to the blocking, now, the actual plan was, do you remember if the actual plan had you guys going up there on, like, G+2?
Which actual plan?
Well, pardon, all right, like...
There was about three of them.
Yes, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
No,
my brigade, what we did was I went up and inserted by air some scouts from the 3rd Battalion 187 so that they could go the ground route that the battalion was going to go, that battalion was going. The rest of the brigade, we went by air on ground plus one, which was February 25th.
Okay.
Into our area by a complete air assault.
All right. So the brigade deployed by air assault on G+1.
Correct.
Okay. And what was there any provisions for a landlock between FOB Cobra and AO Eagle?
Any provisions?
You know, or like, did they plan for a landlock, or was it just going to be, you know, everything comes in by helo?
No, everything was going by helicopter.
Okay.
Up to where I was.
Concerning the anti-armor task force that had to be dropped off at LZ Sand, the first question is...
LZ Sand, that was at Cobra, but my unit went beyond Cobra.
Right. Yeah, but the, yeah, no, but LZ Sand was, it was like 30 miles short of Highway 8, correct?
No.
No?
Not to my knowledge.
Was there a drop zone that was 30 miles short for the anti-armor task force?
There was one from 1st Brigade that was that short, I think.
Okay. But do you remember, you know, why it had to be short and if there were any trouble with them getting up to you guys?
It was short just because of the number of vehicles that were airlifted into it. And there was no problem as far as I know linking up.
Okay. Now, when you landed on Highway 8, did your entire brigade's combat power manage to get up there in time?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the entire brigade airlifted. Okay. Because, you know, like, I was looking at the numbers and it looked like small, but did they leave a lot of the supply and, you know, non-combat units at Cobra or at Campbell?
They left them, we left them in our tactical assembly area.
Yeah, at Campbell, okay. And so then you guys, so then the guys who landed on Highway 8 were solely combat?
Yes.
Okay. And, oh, Pither, I just had a question. All right. Now, let's see. A little bit of a change of topic. Do you know how often non-divisional transport assets, like assets from Corps or Theater or, you know, just other non-101 units, do you know how often, you know, non-101 units were used to support the 101?
No, not really. I know that they were some that were set up in the core area, fairly close to us.
Okay. Oh, the vehicles from the COSCOM?
No, from like we had a transportation unit from out of one of the reserve units that was there, BATH unit that was also there. Up in the tactical assembly area, there was a unit from Puerto Rico. So, I mean, it was units from all over.
Okay. Now, how did the windstorm affect your unit's operations?
It pretty much brought them it was also bad for them. So
that's a good point.
We, you know, kind of dug in, covered up, and weathered the storm.
All right. Now, you mentioned that all your supply, when you guys were cutting Highway 8, was coming in by helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you just give me an overview of what sort of things were coming in?
Water, food, ammunition.
All the usual?
Right.
Okay, but did you guys keep, you know, some classes of supply back at the FOBs or at the assembly area? Or were you guys getting everything?
Just depending on what I needed up front as to what all we got. So, if I didn't need it, then I didn't have it come forward.
So then, for you guys, it was operating as a pull system where you got sent what you needed, and you didn't get sent mounds of ammunition that you didn't need.
Right.
Okay.
If I needed some building material, which came up to help construct a little more stabilized areas for, like, the operation center, then, you know, that would come up. If I didn't need it, I didn't call for it.
How quickly would that stuff generally come up?
It would take, if we made the request, it would be in within the 12 to 24 hours.
That's pretty good. And did it really matter on, you know, time of day, or was it just generally 12 to 24?
It was, just within 12 to 24 hours.
Okay. Would some classes of supply take longer than others?
Generally, they were all about the same.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Now, what was the supply situation of your unit at the ceasefire?
What was the condition of the supplies we had on the ground?
Yeah.
We were at a comfortable level, not too much, not too little. By that I mean we were able to load what we had, supplies that we had on the vehicles that we had that had come up to transport them back without having to use air.
Okay. Now, and when you guys air assaulted in, how much supplies did you air assault in with?
We took 3 days' worth in with us.
Okay, 3 days of fuel. No, not fuel, but 3 days
water.
Of, yeah, water, food, ammo.
Ammo.
Okay. So really just the big three, you know,
right.
1, 3, 5? Okay.
Yep.
And the artillery units. Well, first off, you guys did have artillery units air assaulting in with you guys, right?
Okay.
And do you, and how did that work in terms of having artillery units air assault in?
Worked great. we're able to sling load the guns and the ammo with the guns. It was good. At that time, of course, we beat the weather in. So.
Right. Yes, and that's.
And once the weather cleared, then we were able to move them around a little bit.
So air assault artillery provides a lot of flexibility and mobility for tube artillery, you might say.
Correct.
Okay. And okay.
And we had our mortars with us.
Yes. And now, do you remember how did you air assault in?
With one of the units.
Okay. Did you come in on a Black Hawk or a Chinook?
Black Hawk.
And were you in the first lift or second lift?
In the first lift.
Okay.
For the unit that I went with.
And what was your impression when you stepped off your Black Hawk?
What was my impression when I stepped off?
Yeah.
That it was mighty muddy. where we landed was, like I said, muddy. We had passed over some nomads there and landed in a big open field. And everyone was offloaded very quickly. The weight that we had that everybody was carrying was quite a bit. So, I mean, where we landed was good, as that we did not have to walk a great distance to get into positions that we had already pre-selected. Did have a couple of interpreters or civil affairs folks that went over and talked to the people, and they were picking up and moving out. So that was good.
Okay, and well, did that mud really affect any of your operations?
No.
It was just a minor inconvenience?
Just inconvenience.
Okay. And what sort of reception did you get from the people who were in the area?
Oh, well, they were kind of scared to death, mostly of the helicopters.
I don't blame them. I'd be kind of weirded out by having, you know, helicopters full of armed guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Okay.
Well, one guy was driving his vehicle, and a helicopter sat down in front of him. He looked in his rearview mirror, and there was a helicopter sitting behind him. He just jumped out of his vehicle and started running. Didn't even turn it off or anything.
And he was just a civilian.
Right.
Yeah. It would happen. Let's see here. Was there any enemy contact?
That evening we fired on some traffic that was coming back across the bridge.
Okay. Oh, and how frequent were... How frequently did you have air cover? I mean, aside from the schmall.
Once the weather cleared, air was on call whenever we needed it.
Okay. So there's always helicopters, you know.
Yeah, there's always something there. I would say that we're probably no more than 10 minutes away.
That's good. And, well, you know, so the question I have to ask then is, how capable do you think, or how well do you think you could have defended against an Iraqi, you know, a determined Iraqi thrust?
After the sandstorm?
Yes.
I think we could have held our own, even though we were light and you're talking the Republican Guards were the mechanized force. We could have, you know, held our own. We'd needed some support coming in as well.
Well, right, but again, you said that you had that orbiting, so yeah. Okay. So then, do you think that then the air assault doctrine proved itself then?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now,
we were back behind their considered lines before they even knew what was going on.
And that is something that I've read, that the Iraqis that were taken prisoner at Fob Cobra, one of the things they said, it was that they were basically like, we didn't expect to see you guys for like 4 or 5 days.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, one of my units, the day before ground day, captured 400 people.
That was your unit. And do you remember where that was?
I just know that it was off the TAA there.
Okay.
Basically, they said that we didn't fight fair. We continued to fight at night, and we had the helicopters, and so.
Interesting. You didn't fight fair.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, did you have any concerns about the ground operation?
Did I have concerns?
Yes.
Would it not go well, those kind of things?
Yeah, things that you were worried about, yeah. Or, yeah, things that you thought would go well, things that you thought that wouldn't go well. Just, you know, things that were on your mind. Things that you were thinking about.
No, the only thing I was thinking was, you know, about the soldiers, their reactions. A lot of them having never been to combat before and all. What they may think once they got there. I had no reservations at all that they would, you know, not do well. Every soldier will do well. And that he does not want to let his buddies down.
So esprit de corps.
Right.
Yeah, okay. And were there any problems once you got up to Highway 8? I mean, aside again from the sandstorm.
The normal problems of just readjusting the plan from what was briefed, what was rehearsed, making adjustments as to actually being on the ground, doing the link-ups, ensuring all units were tied together,
Could you detail what was different?
I think where we looked at putting one unit, the ground was not quite the same. I think it was some power lines or something within there.
And power lines would be hazardous for an air assault unit?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's see here. Now, pardon me. How did the mail system work for you? And we're shifting of, you know, obviously back from the ground offensive, and you know, when you were deployed, you know, in Saudi Arabia still.
Mm-hmm.
How did the mail system work?
The postal was not quite ready to handle the volume of mail that was coming, and that being a lot of patriotic Americans sending the letters to any soldier. Well, when you get 5,000 or something like that, the unit, the mail unit, only has about 30 people, and they've got to work 24 hours a day. Then you tie in the holidays of Thanksgiving and Christmas, where you got packages plus letters plus any soldier mail. You know, that's a big burden. I think the postal folks, once they really, you know, understood how things were running, that they did very well.
So, well, do you have any idea of the scale of mail that was coming in, or the scale that was going out?
There was one day, I think there was about four 18-wheeler truckloads of mail come in.
Wow.
One time. Going out, but not quite as much, but there was quite a bit that went out, too.
And did these soldiers write home? Did they write home more at certain points in time, or was it a fairly steady, you know, dribble out?
No, I think it was pretty steady once we got into camp there in Saudi Arabia and kind of settled down. Training, they understood what was going on. Difficulty was when we first got there, there was no lights in the tents, so. Of course, all the letters and all had to either be written under a flashlight or during daylight hours. So,
and thinking about it now, shifting to your arrival, now, what sort of things were scarce when you first arrived?
Well, there was no hot meals. Everything was MRE.
Mm-hmm.
Ready to eat. Water, with bottled water. We ran out of that, so King Fahd had purchased water for us in bags. The bags was all right, but they had a nasty gas taste to them. We you know, got rid of those as fast as we could.
Okay. So then I guess I, you know, was water a problem?
Water was a problem, only in that the amount of exertion that someone did. We tried to ensure that they had to drink like 6 bottles of water in the early stages,
right,
every day. And that's quite a bit of water.
That is quite a bit of water, yes.
Until they get acclimatized and they go down. But not only drink the water, you also need the water. If you want to make your own coffee, to boil that, to clean up in, those kind of things.
Okay. So then after acclimatization, there, would you say that there wasn't a problem with water?
No water. Wasn't a problem.
Okay. Yeah, one of the things that Sergeant Nichols mentioned is that there was wells, like, everywhere.
Out in the towns, there was wells. To utilize those wells, though, or to have access to them, someone had to talk to the town elder, Mukhtar, whatever they called them.
Right.
And then he had to give okay. And that became a problem one time that I heard, just as a rumor, that one of our units had broke a pump which meant that that entire town, that little village, was out of water, because that was where they also got their water. So we had to, of course, go in and replace the pump and get everything fixed back up for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, on a similar vein, is I have to ask about contracting. Did you have any experience, any encounters with contracting, you know, for, you know, host nation contractors, I guess, for anything?
Okay. Personally, I did not tell that Division did, in that they contracted to have the wash area constructed, the showers constructed, the latrines constructed. They had to have someone contracted to come and, of course, pump out the latrines, and they had people contracted to put up the tents.
Now, was that?
They had people contracted to put up the tents that we stayed in.
Now, was that at Camp Eagle 2?
Right, Camp Eagle 2.
Okay, and did Bastogne and Campbell differ at all?
There, we just we had no contractors. We did it ourselves.
Okay, well, so then in that respect, how much did contractors help? You know, I mean, you know, comparing how it was at Bastogne and Campbell to at Camp Eagle 2 when he had contractors. Like, was it like a noticeable difference in the amount of work that you guys had to do?
No. And I say no in that the soldiers needed to do something anyway.
That's true.
Had to stay busy. So, you know, digging a position or going out and burning the waste at the latrines, that, you know, it was all part of burning the actual, you know, paper waste and all that, and the trash, all that is something that needed to be done.
Okay.
The soldiers having to do soldier things, that was good.
Mm. Okay. Well, then, so what sort of things did you do for fun?
For fun?
Yeah. Did you have any fun, first of all?
Every day's a lot of fun in the Army.
Go on.
Basically, just read, write letters home, sit around, just kind of BS with each other, those kind of things.
Hmm. Did you have a favorite book?
Me? No, I didn't.
Okay. Or a favorite topic of conversation to BS about?
No, well, the guy that I kind of shared my tent with, he had a tape of Reba McEntire at that time, and we just kind of listened to it over and over. I did have a Sony radio that was able to pick up BBC, and we would listen to some of the news broadcasts from that.
Was there ever a disconnect between what you were hearing on BBC, what you were hearing through Camp Scuttlebutt, and what you were hearing, like, officially through your chain of command?
What I heard on BBC was what I heard through the chain of command. As far as rumors are always flying. You know, as soon as we touch down in Saudi, someone starts a rumor, oh, we're going home next week, everything's over.
Shh.
And of course, I had to squelch all those types of rumors real quick.
Okay. Did you have a particularly memorable rumor? You know, like one that just stood out as being so, you know, funny or crazy or anything like that?
Yeah, they said we was going home. We'd be home by Christmas, and we're telling this on Christmas Eve.
Well, soldiers will be soldiers.
Yeah.
And so roughly when did the thinking become, you know, the way home is through Kuwait, or the way home is through Baghdad? You know, like, do you know roughly when that became, you know?
No, our mindset, as far as my unit, when we left, I had soldiers to come up and ask how long we're going to be there, so I major, and basically I said, we'll be there until it's over. going to give you a time frame, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 months. We're going to be there, and we will take care of business. Once all that's done, then it's done. So there was no, the way home is this way or that way. It's okay, we're here to do something. As soon as we get it done, then we're out of here.
Very, very task-oriented.
Right.
Okay. Now, let's see. Now, concerning the meals, you had mentioned that when you initially deployed, all you had was MREs.
Correct.
So, first question is, did you have a favorite, or did you get tired of them really quick?
We got tired of them.
All right.
You have MREs for 60 days straight. You just, even when they came out with a T-Rat meal, everybody was happy to get a T-Rat meal until we started eating it, and that's just a bigger MRE.
Well, so what sort of things were in T-Rats?
Almost the same thing as in MRE, but you had it's a big square. You boil them in water to heat them up. You had like square eggs. You had eggs and sausage all in, built into like one little square when they cut it out to serve you.
Hmm. Oh, and would those be prepared with the mobile kitchen trailers, the MKTs?
Correct.
Okay.
But again, all that was boiling water and putting them into water.
Yeah, so...
Two big meals that the cooks did real well were Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Well, they're, yeah, kind of expected to do that because...
Well, on Christmas Day, we were... my unit was up north, the training area, and we had a big sandstorm. All that morning, actually it came in probably about 2 in the morning and lasted until about 11 or 12 that day, Thanksgiving Day. Stopped, everybody could eat. But the cooks had to put up with all that sand flying and preparing food and all that, and that was a great meal.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine. Now, concerning foods that you got from the natives, how often did you eat, fresh food, supplied by natives?
None, except when everything was over and we went back to Saudi Arabia. Then we had contract people cooking.
Okay. Do you know if that differed from the other units, or
I don't know.
No? Okay. Yeah, because Sergeant Nichols told me a story about how the rest of his guys got sick because the lettuce that they had for their salad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, concerning training,
mm-hmm.
how often did you guys go up to train?
Well, we trained there in Saudi at Camp Eagle 2. Daily, and then when we actually went up north a little bit to another training site, then of course we trained there, did some live fires, as well as just normal training that was going on.
Okay, and so what sort of things did you train for, or was it, the gamut of soldier things?
Just the gamut of everything.
Okay. Alright, now, when you were forward deployed, during Desert Shield, when you were forward deployed to serve as a defense, what was that like, in terms of whatever?
What was it like?
Yeah, in terms of whatever you'd like to speak about, supplies, how it was, or whatever.
It was just, it was good that we had that amount of time to get acclimated and let soldiers continued to train where they felt a little more confident, not only in their abilities, but in their leader's ability to get them through whatever needed to be gotten through. So that was a good part. It was stupid on Saddam's part allowing us to take that long to build up to go against him. But
yeah. But I'm sure neither one of us is complaining that he did give us that time.
Oh, no. I'm glad.
Okay. Now, all right, so now it's time for very much miscellaneous scattered questions. was there any culture shock when you arrived in Saudi Arabia and when you were operating in Saudi Arabia?
Basically, since we were isolated from the populace, it wasn't a big thing. The only problem is that the only people that came in contact with those contractors that came out like to clean up the latrines.
Right.
But very limited talking to as far as that went. So, you know, training out there was limited as far as the entire unit talking with any other foreign. We did it at one time while training, talk with the Saudi army a little bit because they were in the training site, but not all the soldiers talked with them. So you know, that was different. The other part was just the normal, you know, customs that they have that are a little different than ours. Don't look at the women, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But again, it did not have that big a problem because we were not exposed that much.
Hmm. Okay. Now, what about tobacco products? Were there any problems with tobacco products? And if so, how did you solve them?
Yeah, well, as far as myself, I had no problem because I don't smoke or dip or anything like that. But as far as the soldiers, they were, you know, of course, sending home, getting care packages from home. Care packages come in with cigarettes. We would do that. I know when we was up in the tactical assembly area, sergeant majors of the battalions collected money because they were able to go into one of the little towns, and they bought a lot of cigarettes and Skoal, those kind of stuff, tobacco products to take back to the soldiers before we actually went up.
Right. Okay, now, when you arrived in Saudi Arabia, again, could you remind me when you arrived in Saudi Arabia?
September.
Okay. Now, when you did arrive, how much of your brigade's equipment was there? I mean, either flew in with you or arrived on ship, or was supplied through pre-positioned supplies or what have you?
I would probably say about 80%.
80% of what?
Of the equipment was there.
And arrived on ship?
On ship and what we brought.
Okay. So and were there any deficiencies in what you had when you arrived?
No, not really.
No major deficiencies. It was just a little bit of everything was missing.
Yeah, you know, a little bit of this got messed up in the movement or in the ship or something, but nothing big. Mission stopping.
Okay. Let's see. All right, so then the question I have to ask now is, what did you think the logistics guys did right?
What did they do right?
Yeah. And conversely, what do you think they did wrong? I mean, it's a very, very vague question, so feel free to take your time.
As far as my logistics folks, they were very good at trying to forecast and get to what was needed prior to, you know, being requisitioned and knowing that things were going to come up. So they were proactive in getting things from DISCOM to try and get it out to the soldiers.
Is that unusual?
No, that's them doing their job.
Or at least doing their job well, right?
You're right.
Right, okay. Okay. And so that's what they did right. And was there anything that you feel that they could have done better?
Sometimes they could have. They could have, again, been able to talk to DISCOM to see about what other comfort items could have been available for soldiers.
Hmm. Yes. Oh, and on that, you know, concerning care packages, concerning, you know, I guess you might call them, you know, luxury items like soda pop or chocolate or what have you, were they in short supply for for your guys?
In short supply.
As in, you know, you should have been getting more than you actually did?
No, I don't think we should have been getting any more, because water was more important than trying to get sodas, even if, you know, you put like the Kool-Aid in the water or something.
Right.
That's better for you than the sodas, so the sodas stuff, that was okay.
Okay. And, let's see here. Right. So now here's an extremely broad question. Are there any questions that you think should be asked about Desert Storm? You know, what sort of issues do you think you need to be addressed?
No, I think pretty much everything has been addressed over the years. The one thing though that I will say that supply messed up on was boots.
Hmm.
We never got our desert boots until we got back to Fort Campbell.
Mm.
And then they wanted us to do a parade in those boots. And we said no.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the uniforms, they weren't necessarily desert uniforms either. They could have been the greens.
We had tan desert uniforms. Most of, well, I think all of my unit had those. They were two per soldier at the time, and then while we were over there, we got issued another two, I think.
Wait, so you got issued two desert uniforms,
right?
But you got issued zero desert boots.
Correct.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it makes sense to somebody somewhere, but it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, at that time, the desert uniforms had been used before. Desert boots was not even a thought, as people were using mostly jungle boots.
Mm.
But jungle boots in the desert is okay, but in jungle boots you have a little eyelet in there to let water out. Well, if you have an eyelet in there, it lets sand in.
Yes.
So that was the problem. Although I wore jungle boots most of the time anyway. Mm.
And the sand getting let in, was it just an inconvenience, or were there actually...
Well, if you're going for a long walk and with a heavy load, don't have to be real long, and you have sand coming in those inlets, then your friction with not only your socks, but your feet on there, which is like almost like glass you're walking on.
Hmm. So were there people who were, you know, injured enough to have to go to the medics by this?
No.
Okay.
No. Again, that's due to the small unit leader, the team leader, squad leaders, constantly checking their people, being with them.
Okay. All right, so the responsibility of the squad leader kept your guys in fighting shape.
Correct.
Okay. Well, then, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that a hallmark of, well, really any unit in the Army?
Mm.
Yeah. Well, you know, like you said earlier, they're all good.
That's right. They're all good.
Okay. All right.
All right.
I think that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Unless you can think of any, I do have a couple more questions that I just, you know, thought of. Well, first though, again, do you think that there are any questions aside from where the deficiency in boots? Are there any other questions that you feel should be asked?
No.
Okay. Now, how about, you know, swapping out of broken equipment? You know, repair parts, swapping out broken equipment, exchanging broken equipment. How did that work?
It was slow, but that's because of everything was being built up to come there. So how did it come? Come by ship most of the time. If it was, big parts or things like that were critical, then they could get them by air.
Hmm.
So just the price that you pay for being away from your normal supply areas.
Right. Okay. And, do you know if there was anything that was more or less a showstopper in terms of, repair parts not being there?
No.
Or equipment that, couldn't be easily swapped out? I mean, was everything slow, or were some things slower than others?
No, I think everything was, slow. Like I said, if it was real critical, then it was flown in, so... Okay. I mean, the supply system of the Army is just the way it is.
Mm. Yeah, that's how it is. But, now here's the thought. How did the supply situation, the logistics, how did the supply situation differ between Vietnam and Desert Storm?
Vietnam, I was only there in the early stages, like 66, 67.
Okay.
And as a private up to sergeant, I didn't see any problem with supplies, vehicles, ammunition, any of that other stuff at my unit. And any time I needed something, if we needed to replace something, that was no problem at all. Just, turn into broken and get something back.
Okay.
Now, later units, later in the war, there may have been some problems.
I was asking because I didn't know, just thought of it as a comparison.
Yeah.
But basically, now when you were in Vietnam, though, the logistical network was, it was more or less, set up and had been operating for a couple years, right?
Had been set up because the first unit went in 65, May of 65. The first Army Combat Unit, which was the 173rd, went in, and they were stationed in Okinawa. So basically, as far as supplies, getting it into Vietnam, out of Japan, Okinawa, Korea, those were fairly close, so you get those in.
Whereas getting supplies in the Gulf, the only real place that might have supplies would be, what, like Diego Garcia? I mean, sure, you could get fuel from Saudi Arabia, but, in terms of other supplies, everything came in. But essentially, in Vietnam, it took, roughly, it took about 2 years, and with, at least two major places to draw upon, and you had a pretty good supply network.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Gulf, you had a decent, if not, would you say pretty good supply network, running right off the ground without any major suppliers anywhere close?
It was pretty fair, but you had Europe that was close.
Oh, yes, that's true.
So, you can get stuff out of there. It was just the politics of playing with the State Department and all that.
Okay. Oh, and did you have any contact with Saudi officials, or was it really, like you said, you didn't have much contact?
Mm-mm.
Okay. All right. Now, do you have anything else to add about anything at all?
No.
All right.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
And I'll be, I'll be mailing this this form to you.
Okay.
Shortly.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
And this.
Hope you get an A.
I hope I get. Well, it's for my thesis, so it's, it's supposed to be a good 80 to 100
right.
pages.
Yeah.
So.